in our second hour.
So let's go right to that interview. Norman Solomon, Reese Ehrlich were in our studios just about last Friday, I think. Here's that interview.
As we continue to listen to the drum beats of war more and more, I think a lot of people, including a lot of the listeners to this station, are feeling like they need some help in decoding what the mainstream media is trying to tell them. It's pretty clear that the mainstream media is sort of doing cattle journalism at this point, if I could use that term, all sort of going along on the same pack and drum beating as much as our politicians are. So we're really lucky and fortunate to have here in the Bay Area and joining us today in the studio, two people who can decode and let us know what is really going on. Reese Ehrlich and Norman Solomon are, I think, two of the greatest names in media analysis right now, especially for those of us who consider ourselves to be progressive. They have put together a new book entitled Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And again, it's by Norman Solomon, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and well-known syndicating columnist, and also Reese Ehrlich, foreign correspondent, it says here. He's also an award-winning producer of The Russia Project, a radio program hosted by Walter Cronkite. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. And I'm so glad. It's very interesting that as we're doing this interview, we sort of can see in the distance the CNN showdown with Iraq headlines telling us about, oh, the orange alert and how aggravated the troops are getting because they're ready to start war and we're just not ready to get them going. So let me just start with you, Norman, and maybe you could tell us what you're feeling as we're seemingly getting closer to the war of what the media is doing.
Well, you refer to cattle journalism, and it's really, I think, an apt phrase. You know, the push is to be ahead of the pack, but not out of step. And I found from three visits now to Baghdad since last September that a lot of the U.S. journalists there, hardworking, adverse conditions, frustrated because a lot of their feeds and stories have to go through the meat grinder back home, and pretty soon they got to internalize what the spin is from the punditocracy back home, and that really damages the kind of stories and coverage we ultimately get back here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Reese, same question to you.
Well, I think it's the starting point is that Washington is where the story is at, not Iraq, as far as most American reporters are concerned. That is, you can go to Iraq, you can find interesting things, you can find interesting stories, but everything has to come back to what does Washington say. And my favorite one is, no matter how bold-faced the lies are, you have to treat them with a straight face. So allow me for a moment to quote from the New York Times of February 12th of this year, in which the U.S. has admitted that it plans currently to invade and occupy Iraq for 2 years and place General Tommy Franks in charge of the country, which is a benevolent a way of running the country. I suppose most objective observers would call that a military dictatorship. Uh-huh. Now, here, those are the facts. Now, this is quoted now from an administration source who says, quote, "We will demonstrate to the Iraqi people and the world that the United States wants to liberate, not occupy or control their economic resources." And that's treated straight-faced. Hello? The U.S. invades, occupies a country, takes over its oil fields, and then you quote something like that without any derision, scorn, or criticism. Hey, that's not journalism. That's stenography for those in power.
Well, this reminds me so much of General MacArthur in 1945 taking over Japan. And allegedly, MacArthur's administration of Japan was benevolent, and the Japanese, of course, ultimately prospered and became well off. So the other thing that has occurred is the question of, well, who's going to pay for this war, given that the last war was paid for by the Saudis and others. This time it's being alleged that maybe the U.S. will just take over the Iraqi oil fields, and that's how this war will be paid for. But that might feed into the notion that the purpose of U.S. going to war was to take the oil away from Iraq in the first place, and we don't want to feed into that.
Yeah, first, just a quick comment on the analogy to Japan or Germany after the war. Obviously, the situations are entirely different because Japan had been a imperial power conquering much of Asia, as had Germany and Europe. And the question, theoretically, in Germany, it was a joint occupation of a aggressive imperial power, very different from the U.S. plans for Iraq to basically go it alone. But on the issue of who pays for it, yeah, that's the other question that is either not asked by the media or whispered, shall we say. And that's because the answer is so embarrassing and so disastrous for the administration. Estimates by the administration, by the way, range from $100 billion to $200 billion at a time when we're already running a record deficit for this kind of an economy. And it's so bad that when the Bush administration put forward its new budget, it didn't even include the cost for the war because they say we can't, well, we can't tell, so we can't include it. So the bill comes later. It's roughly like me saying, well, I think I'll buy 3 new houses. I don't know how much they'll cost, but we'll take care of the mortgages later. It don't work that way. And, of course, one of the reasons the media does that is because leading top-level Democrats aren't criticizing, are not holding Bush's feet to the fire on this. So the media doesn't raise it on their own either, and so therefore the question's not answered. On the issue that you raised about paying, taking over the oil fields to pay for it, yeah, I mean, that is what colonial powers have done for centuries. You know, the British go into India and take over the country and then force the people there, the resources, to go to British companies. Well, when the U.S. goes into Iraq, who is going to get the contracts to rebuild the oil wells and the pipelines and so on? Halliburton. And it's pure coincidence that Halliburton used to be headed up by Dick Cheney. I want to emphasize that it's pure coincidence.
Pure coincidence.
You know, back in December, one of the very poignant moments for me was I was traveling around Baghdad with some UNICEF officials and with Sean Penn and some Iraqi officials, and we were having lunch, and other folks drifted off, and I was sitting with the driver, who is Iraqi, and it was very quiet. It was a beautiful day. It was hard to imagine just a few hundred feet from the Tigris River that the missiles would be coming in, perhaps in a matter of a couple of months. And he paused, and in his broken English, he said, "Petrol. If no petrol, no problems." And it's very painful to see the realization. It reminds me of back the story of soon after Columbus arrived in North America, the Arawak Indians on the island taking the gold and throwing it in the ocean in hopes that that would get these Europeans out of there.
Beck, go take a swim. Go get it there. Well, Norman Solomon, you just brought up what I wanted to ask you next, which is you have traveled to Baghdad. You've taken at least two different trips there and gone with Sean Penn, which we can ask you more about. But I think that that's one of the things, again, very much missing from the mainstream media is any sense of who the people of Iraq are. All we seem to hear about is this demon figure of Saddam Hussein and the attempt to put the, as one guest said to us, the beard of Osama bin Laden, attach that onto him. So can you give us more of what you experienced being there and talking to the people who are parents, sons, daughters, human beings just like the rest of us?
Yeah, well, Reese has written some chapters based on his travel in different parts of Iraq. My visits were pretty much confined to Baghdad. And so in late January, for instance, just a few weeks ago, when I went with the former UN official Dennis Halliday, we went to the souk, to the market in Baghdad. It was on a Friday. And we wandered around and talked to people with no minders. We just went by ourselves. And they were folks who Dennis had met when he was stationed there in the late 90s, rug sellers, for instance, merchants. And it was very painful in the quiet moments to hear them ask us, what do you think the chances are of the missiles coming? I mean, people are used to the adversity, the 12 years of sanctions, the previous war. But there was a very a painful moment that I described early on in the book where I was at a water treatment plant, this was back in December, that had been bombed by the U.S. in 1991 and still very damaged. And we had a guide, an Iraqi woman, who talked very almost matter-of-factly about the technical matters of how the water treatment is still damaged there. And then an American young woman who was with us said, "You're strong," you know, as if to comfort the Iraqi woman. And the reply was, "No, not strong." And her eyes began to tear. And then she said, we're tired. And we have this sense as Americans that perhaps people are so accustomed to the adversity, to the bombs, to the sanctions, to the threat of more bombs, that they can hold up. And the empirical data and the anecdotal information as well says they're worn down, and this next war will be much more difficult to endure.
Can I ask you, Risa, a comment about your travels in Iraq?
Sure. Probably the most interesting interchange I had with Iraqis was, again, away from the government minders, who as a reporter are assigned to you and follow you everywhere. But one night we were able to get away, visit the home of our taxi driver outside of Baghdad, and had a conversation with a large number of people. And basically what they said was they don't like Saddam Hussein. He led them into two disastrous wars, one against Iran, one in Kuwait. The sanctions have taken their toll on the economy. And these people, several of them were quite educated, and they're basically running small businesses because that's all they can do. But they said, as bad as Saddam Hussein is, we don't want the U.S. coming in and telling us who our new government is going to be. And he started going through the lists of names of people who were the exiled leaders at that time that were being floated. And he says, who are these people? They don't have any political base here. We only know one name, and that's from BBC and Voice of America. So all these exiled leaders that the U.S. is promoting are not known there, don't have a political base. And so therefore, that's why the U.S. is coming up with this alternative of imposing a U.S. military dictator on the country for however long it takes. So the Iraqis are very much worried about substituting a anti-U.S. repressive dictator with a pro-U.S. repressive dictator. They don't want that.
Well, I think all of us can agree that Saddam Hussein is a horrible person. He was horrible back when he was a big ally of the United States during the Iran-Iraq War, when he used poison gas on the Iranians primarily, but the story about him gassing his own people, of course. United States, when he was our ally, didn't care, didn't give a bleep about that.
They provided him with some of the weapons of mass destruction.
Right, provided him with the poison gas, etc. Given that, so many American people are convinced by the logic, if you want to call it that, of George W. Bush, that this guy's got to go. And the only way he apparently will go is by being overthrown militarily. So that is very convincing to a lot of people.
Well, we deconstruct a lot of the arguments. For instance, there are many regimes that torture their citizens. Some of them get huge aid from the United States, like Egypt, billions a year. Certainly that's not a media issue here. So, you know, it would be logical if your government is against torture, they would stop paying for it as a first step before sending missiles in to another country. There's also the fact about the UN resolutions. We talk in the book about the fact that there are about 100 UN Security Council resolutions currently longstanding and currently being violated by various countries, Turkey, Israel, Morocco, Indonesia. You don't hear about those in the media. You hear about the U.S. is going to enforce the 16 or so resolutions that Iraq has been violating. Well, if you take that standard, then what's to stop any country in the world from bombing Turkey or Morocco or Israel or whatever on the basis that they are enforcing these other U.N. Security Council resolutions? Mm-hmm. You strip it away, and it's really about might makes right. And if we're going to have a foreign policy based on that, let's call it what it is.
You just heard from Norman Solomon, public, well-known media analyst and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Also joining us here in the studio, Reese Ehrlich, foreign correspondent. I love that sort of wide-open title, Reese. And he's also a producer and also a well-known writer. And we're talking about the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And it also includes an introduction by Howard Zinn and an afterword by Sean Penn. And I do want to ask you, Reese, or Norman, both of you, I need some help with why the American public seemingly is so convinced and unable to sort of look beneath what the mainstream media spoons out to them. I find this to be very puzzling because I don't think our population is stupid, and I don't think that they, on some level, don't question some of what's being told to them, but you just don't hear many of those voices. How is this happening? Is it such corporate control that they can't think beyond what's being presented to them? I don't know. Norman, Reese, whoever.
Yeah, no, I think, first of all, there is tremendous anti-war sentiment in this country, mm-hmm. bubbling up
Absolutely.
From below. And I visited Klamath Falls, Oregon, small town, 25,000 people, very conservative community. Last January, during the big anti-war demonstrations here and other places, 300 people showed up in Klamath Falls. Now, that's unprecedented, even in the period of the Vietnam War, when the